All right, so today we are completing the picture of inflation. Let us put it all into context. Here is a simplified version, an overview of our current understanding of cosmology. This axis, on roughly a logarithmic scale, indicates everything from the very earliest epoch that we don't really know much about, the Planck era, all the way to the infinite future. So we do not know what happened before a Planck time. It could be that the universe was spawned by some other universe, or there could be some other origin. We do not really know. We can only speculate. However, then at some point, it currently appears as if a period of inflation kicked in, which probably came to an end at about 10 to the minus 32 seconds. During the period of inflation, the energy momentum tensor was dominated by the potential of a scalar field. The energy in particular was dominated by the energy of a scalar field. The pressure was negative to that, and therefore the ratio of the pressure over the energy density was about minus one. This is also what you would get with a cosmological constant, and this is the constellation of energy density and pressure that triggers exponential or almost exponential expansion. So the equation of state parameter, the ratio of pressure over energy density, was about minus one here. Then inflation at some point ended, and the universe no longer expanded in an accelerated fashion. Instead, it was filled with radiation that was produced from the energy density that the inflaton used to have. And that radiation was very hot. The energy momentum tensor in that period was dominated by radiation, such as photons, but initially also all sorts of other particles. And in fact, before the electroweak phase transition, all particles could be viewed as being massless. They only acquire a mass, according to the standard model of particle physics, at low enough energies for the symmetry breaking to kick in. During radiation domination, the energy density is positive, of course, but also the pressure is positive. And the ratio of pressure over energy density is then observed. That is just what comes out of calculating the energy density for a universe that's filled with radiation. So it was plus one third, which means that at the end of inflation, the equation of state parameter, which is what governs how the interaction between matter and gravity behaves, that jumped from minus one, or about minus one, on the way to plus one third. And then at some point, the universe cooled down enough, well, let's put it this way, radiation dilutes faster than matter does. So that means that as the universe expanded, the dilution of radiation was faster than the dilution of matter, and eventually matter started to dominate in the energy momentum tensor. Briefly, why is it that the energy density in the radiation drops faster with expansion than the energy density of matter does? Well, take a photon, for example, like a photon gas. If you have so many photons in a box, if the box expands, the density of photons goes down. As usual, this goes with the third power of the scale factor, because the volume goes like the third power. But photons also get their wavelength stretched as the space is expanding. And that means that the energy density in a photon gas actually goes down with the fourth power of the scale factor.
three powers because of the volume factor and one power because of the stretching of the wavelength. Now, if you have a box full of protons, they will dilute in number, but they will not become less massive just because the box gets larger. Therefore, the energy density of matter only decays with the third power of the scale factor. So it had to happen that a universe that was, that the universe when it was initially radiation dominated, at some point in time became matter dominated, meaning that the energy momentum tensors energy density was dominated by matter rather than by radiation. And that transition was at about 10 to the 13th seconds. Before that, what happened during the radiation domination phase? Well, initially everything was massless because the Higgs effect hadn't kicked in yet and hadn't given particles their mass. Then at about 10 to the minus 11 seconds, the electroweak phase transition kicks in and particles acquire a mass. But still the universe is radiation dominated. At about 1 second old, the universe forms nuclei. And then at about 10 to the 13 seconds, matter starts dominating the energy momentum tensor. At about 10 to the 5 years, at about 370,000 years, we have that atoms form. The universe has at that point cooled down so much that protons and electrons can start sticking together, forming hydrogen. Of course, there's also some helium around, but the dominant gas is hydrogen. And hydrogen gas, just like helium gas, is transparent. So whereas previously photons were not traveling very far because they would run into ions all the time, into electrons and protons and charges, after this event that the universe became transparent, photons were free to travel freely. And they've been traveling ever since, and this is what forms the cosmic microwave background today. Then if we follow that period of matter domination, at about today, at about 10 to the minus 19 seconds, plus minus, you know, I mean, actually minus a few billion years, we have that dark energy is starting to dominate the energy momentum tensor. So today, the matter, so protons, neutrons, and electrons, and so on, still contributes significantly to the energy momentum tensor, but actually dark energy contributes much more to the energy momentum tensor. It constitutes about 70% of all the contributions to the energy momentum tensor. And the remaining 30% are mostly dark matter, and the visible matter just makes up a few percent. And we really don't know what's happening in this direction here. But as far as the equation of state parameter is concerned, between inflation it was about minus one. Today it's approaching minus one again. And in the meantime it was a third for radiation domination. And then during the period where the universe was dominated, the energy momentum tensor of the universe was dominated by matter, the matter could be described basically as a gas of particles, each particle being a galaxy. And in this case, it would be a pressureless gas. So the equation of state parameter, being pressure divided by energy density, is zero. Well, now it's approaching minus one again. So if you wanted to plot the curve of the equation of state parameter, it would start out with minus one, and then go up to a third, to zero, and minus one again. During inflation, quantum fluctuations of the intrinsic curvature and the inflaton field and of gravitational waves were produced, and today we will finish those calculations. Then they were imprinted on the primordial hot plasma that was generated when the energy density that was in the inflaton potential turned into the production of all sorts of particles. And then we had initially this gas of this plasma that filled the universe. which at this point became, as we said, transparent the moment that atoms form. And apart from the cosmic microwave background, the universe was dark then, because there were no stars. Actually, just recently, a few days ago, I mean, a week or two ago, there was an announcement that indirect effects of the lighting up of the very first stars have been observed for the first time with a small telescope in Australia that was dedicated to that purpose. So initially, the universe you could think of as being in principle dark, no sources of light other than the pre-existing CMB, and just gas. But then eventually, of course, over densities of gas would become more pronounced, under densities would become more pronounced, and we get into the nonlinear regime, and stars and galaxies start to condense. It's still not entirely clear what happened first, that the gas clouds condensed into galaxies within which then afterwards the stars condensed, or whether it was first the stars forming and then collecting together into galaxies. In principle, all of this, the in principle structure of structure formation is known and is studied in great detail nowadays. Of course, we are not concerned in this course with this business, we are just concerned with the very beginning of it. And what do we see from the very beginning? Well, we want to see two things. One is the temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And this is a map of actually observed temperature fluctuations in the CMB. And that's another representation of it. This is just like a map of the world, that kind of projection. And this is as if you were looking at the CMB not outwards, but inward. The CMB has an average temperature of 27 millikelvin, that's what it is. Microkelvin, that's right. 2.7 Kelvin, that's right. 2.7 Kelvin plus minus tens of microkelvins. Does anybody of you know how this is being measured? How can you measure temperatures so accurately? It's actually an ingenious way how this is being measured. Using telescopes in which every pixel is a little bit of superconductor, and it is tweaked in such a way that it's just exactly at the superconducting transition temperature. And so the tiniest of change of temperature that this superconductor is exposed to makes you go from superconducting to non-superconducting. And that transition, as it being a phase transition, is a very steep curve. And so you get a tremendous sensitivity. It's rather ingenious. Now, the CMB consists of about 411, just for order of magnitude, 411 photons per cubic centimeter. So this is all being measured with great accuracy. If we zoom in, it looks like this, and these white lines here are indicating the measured polarization in the CMB. As I mentioned before, the polarization field, viewed as a vector field, can be decomposed into its curl and into its gradient part. The gradient part having its origin mostly in the temperature fluctuations, but the curl part having its origin mostly in the primordial gravitational waves. Except that foreground stuff, basically dust in galaxies, can turn some of the temperature fluctuations into polarization fluctuations. So it will be a challenge to disentangle actual gravitational wave-induced polarization fluctuations, to disentangle them from what are depolarization fluctuations that have a different origin. Now, we wanted to predict all those things. And to that end, remember, we took the inflaton field and decomposed it into its zero mode, into its spatially constant part, plus a part that is all the other modes, And that part was assumed to be smaller and was quantized, and the zero mode was considered the bulk of it, driving the expansion of the universe, and was considered classical. Similarly, we proceeded with the metric. We wrote the metric as the scale factor times the Minkowski metric, this being the zero mode of the metric, plus perturbations. These perturbations were assumed to be small, and we quantized them. And this is considered to be dominant. We consider that non-linearly, non-perturbatively, and quantize that. Then we decomposed the metric perturbations into three components, the scalar, the vector, and the tensor parts, and they had all these different functions in them. And then we discussed that we can use the freedom to choose gauge. We can choose the freedom, we can use the freedom to choose coordinate systems. Just to say, we can choose we can use the freedom to choose how we slice space-time into space-like hypersurfaces to make convenient choices and to get rid of a lot of those functions that parameterize the perturbations of the metric. We're simply exploiting the fact that much of the variation in the metric tensor is due to our choice of coordinate system and not due to the physics of it. What we're really interested in is the fluctuations, the variations in the metric that are due to the physics. And we found that there are two parts that are physical. One part is the purely tensorial part of the metric, the Hij contribution. And if you remember, Hij of the metric is the part that describes gravitational waves. And mathematically, it's the part that cannot be written as consisting of derivatives of either vector or scalar fields. And secondly, there was another part of the metric that was gauge invariant, that was physical, therefore. And that part, because of the Einstein equation, can actually not be strictly distinguished from the perturbations of the inflaton field. And these degrees of freedom that I'm talking about now are the Mukhanov variables. This field R of x and eta is a linear combination of a scalar field that arose in the decomposition of the metric and the perturbation of the inflaton field with this prefactor that we motivate. So these two degrees of freedom, these two kinds of degrees of freedom, the gravitational waves and the Mukhanov variable, have their own separate actions. In principle, of course, all those things couple. For example, the gravitational waves interact with the Mukhanov variable. And that's because gravity is highly nonlinear. So it is as if it is a theory that is self-interacting. Every gravitational degree of freedom is coupled to every other gravitational degree of freedom. But to lowest order in perturbation theory, they do decouple. And they have their own individual actions. I should say about this approximation that a lot of effort nowadays goes into finding evidence for contributions from higher order interactions where they're no longer free. And this goes under the keyword of non-Gaussianity. What Gaussianity means is that if you have free quantum field theories, and by free I mean no external driving forces, only parametric driving because of space-time, but no external driving, no interactions between fields or self-interaction. If you have a free quantum field theory, it is always Gaussian. And what that means is that if you want to calculate the same way that you calculate the correlation function between two factors of the field, you know, vacuum expectation value, field here, field there, you can also calculate the correlation function for more than two fields. You can calculate how is the fluctuation here correlated to fluctuations there and there. Right? So you have a three-point correlator or a four-point correlator and so on. And you can tell from the way that our calculations went that, for example, all our three-point correlators would be zero. You see that, why they all are zero?
Because you have an odd number of creation operators.
Exactly. Right. And you can't have as many creation as annihilation operators in this way in there, and so it just can never give you a finite contribution. There's never going to be a three-point correlator. And the four-point correlators are always products of two-point correlators. And generally, there are only even number correlators, and all the odd correlators are zero. The even correlators are always products of two-point correlators. And that is what is called a Gaussian theory. So what you can do is you can take the data in the same way and check for three-point correlators. If there are three-point correlators, it tells you, oh, it's not, you know, our approximation is not perfect. We have to go beyond. Now, we don't really have firm evidence for non-Gaussianity, but it has to be there, because we know that gravity ultimately couples everything.
And at some point, non-Gaussianity must be there. It just could be that it's still too weak to be measured. Okay, but so far we stay here in the Gaussian regime, where we have a separate action for the tensorial part of the metric. This is how it looks like, and that is the separate action for the Mukhanov, for gravitational waves, and for the Mukhanov variable. And remember that for the gravitational waves, the action was formally exactly like the action that we've studied all along. Only difference is a numerical prefactor here, and the fact that these gravitational waves, the hij, are tensorial. So as we saw, there are actually 2 degrees of freedom in this, even though it's actually a 3x3 matrix. There are 2 independent polarizations, polarization directions there. And for the Mukhanov variable, we found that because it is such a subtle linear combination of the scalar part of the metric and the inflaton field multiplied with this prefactor here, we have that the action is again formally just like the actions that we considered all along in this course, except that the scale factor is slightly modified into this factor z. But other than that, it's the same thing. We just have to deal with z as we dealt with a before. And the relationship between the z and the a is this. What we should anticipate in this is that when we calculate the strength of the quantum fluctuations, then in the case of gravitational waves, we can immediately use the results that we had obtained early about how strong the quantum fluctuations are, because this is literally the same action, except for this prefactor here and the fact that we have to treat the polarization separately. But for the Mukhanov variable, we should anticipate that the formula for the magnitude of the fluctuations will be somewhat different. Because what used to be A now is a Z. What used to be A prime over A, what used to be the Hubble parameter here, will be something different here. It will be Z prime over Z. And that means that the magnitude of the quantum fluctuations here should come out different from the magnitude of the quantum fluctuations there, because both ultimately derive from A dot over A or Z dot over Z. And that's, of course, what we will find. But that is posing a challenge, but in a good way, because it means that there are constraints. The way that, I mean, the relative magnitude of the fluctuations that we predict for the temperature fluctuations here and the polarization fluctuations there have a particular relationship to each other that is peculiar to inflation. So if we find some other relationship, the inflationary theory is in trouble. If, on the other hand, we find the predicted relationship, it is a further confirmation of that theory. Okay, so how do we get there? Remember, we in order to quantize this theory, we proceed along the path that we outlined, that we developed throughout the course. We take the original variable, such as here the Mukhanov variable, and then multiply it with the scale factor, but for the Mukhanov variable, that's replaced by the Z, in order to obtain a new field variable such that the friction term goes away out of the Klein-Gordon equation. And similarly for the gravitational waves, for the tensorial part of the metric, we multiply with the scale factor and some historical prefactor and get a new field variable such that the friction term goes away from the Klein-Gordon equation. Further, we took the matrix that describes the gravitational wave and we decomposed it into its two polarizations. So then the gravitational wave field is written as the sum over the two polarizations, lambda equal 1, lambda equal 2. And then these epsilon matrices are basis matrices in the space of polarizations. And here are the mode functions. The main thing to keep in mind here is that we will get a mode function for one polarization and a mode function for the other polarization. And both of them obey the Klein-Gordon equation without friction term. So our equations of motion are then these. For the case of the gravitational waves, where we have these polarization mode functions, the Klein-Gordon equation is this one with the scale factor here. And then for the Mukhanov variable, or actually the associated variable u, for the Mukhanov variable, we get this Klein-Gordon equation without a friction term, except that now the scale factor is replaced by this function z. So what then about the quantum fluctuations? As we saw before, what this means is that this reduces to solving the equations of motion for the mode functions which are number valued. So in principle, remember, these things should have hats on them. Right? These are the quantum fields. But then in order to solve this quantum field theory, we make the usual ansatz with creation and annihilation operators and mode functions, obeying the Wronskian condition, etc. And in particular, we get mode functions. Let's call them u tilde just to indicate that they're not the ones with the hat. These are number-valued functions, and these number-valued mode functions have to obey the Klein-Gordon equation then. Remember that the mode functions have to obey the Klein-Gordon equation so that the operator-valued functions can obey the Klein-Gordon equation. So the Mukhanov variable's associated field has to obey this kind, fields mode functions have to obey this Klein-Gordon equation, and for the for the gravitational waves, the mode functions have to obey that Klein-Gordon equation. Everything as usual, and they also have to obey the Wronskian condition. Now, what shall we choose for the initial conditions? Well, at early times, the k squared term will dominate. And that is early times where the physical wavelength of a mode was much smaller than the horizon. In this case, as we saw earlier, we have that, in effect, the mode doesn't behave as if the space-time was expanding. It's just evolving as if it was a Minkowski space. Therefore, we choose the vacuum of Minkowski space for that mode. We could also be a little bit more careful, and we could say, well, it's not quite Minkowski space, but it's in an adiabatic phase. And then we could choose to use the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion in order to fix the mode functions beginning, to fix, therefore, what the vacuum state is, what the initial state of the quantum field is. And it would be basically the same, because if we go back early enough in time, then the adiabatic vacuum just becomes the Minkowski space. In the case of cosmology, this choice of vacuum state is called the Bunch-Davies vacuum. Then what are the mode functions at late times? at late times, the mode K crossed the Hubble horizon. Because remember, if you hold the mode K fixed, the physical wavelength that it corresponds to grows along with the universe. And at some point, every mode reaches a size which starts exceeding the horizon. Except if inflation ends earlier, right? That means that in the Klein-Gordon equation, these terms dominate. And the harmonic oscillator is inverted. But after horizon crossing, the harmonic oscillators are inverted, and we have this different behavior. So then, instead of having two oscillating basis functions, such as the sine and the cosine, or e to the power of I omega t and e to the power minus I omega t, we then have one exponentially growing solution and one exponentially decaying solution, where you have to be careful because we don't want to subscribe to the sitter inflation here, where it would be exactly exponential. We will make things a bit more realistic today by going away from the sitter inflation. But either way, what we expect is, even if it's not exact the sitter, what we expect is that we get one growing solution and one decaying solution, instead of having two oscillatory solutions that simply rotate in different directions in a complex plane. So after the soon after the horizon crossing, the mode function consists basically only of the growing solution. It's a bad approximation, though, to say that the decaying solution is completely absent. I mean, it can be for practical purposes a good approximation, but fundamentally, we can never neglect the decaying solution. And the reason is that if we took only the growing solution, for example, then our mode function might be completely real, right? Because it's just one solution. But we know that the mode function cannot be completely real or completely imagined, because that would contradict the Wronskian condition. You always really have to have both. Okay, but numerically, soon after horizon crossing, the mode function consists essentially only of the growing solution. And I'm talking here about the mode function of the associated variable, the one which doesn't have a friction term. That mode function has one growing solution and one decaying solution. But if we then translate all of that back into the original physical field, the Mukhanov variable, or the gravitational wave, then we have to divide by the scale factor. And what we will see is that if we divide by the scale factor, then instead of having one growing solution, one decaying solution, we have one solution that goes constant and one decaying solution. The reason is that the growing solution grows at exactly the rate at which the universe is expanding. So if you divide by the scale factor, then we get the constant. Okay, so let's look at the growing solution at late times. Here are the equations of motion after horizon crossing. This is the equation of motion for the gravitational waves. You can see that because there's a lambda which indicates the two polarizations. Lambda takes value 1 or 2 for the two polarization directions of gravitational fields. And also we recognize that this is the equation of motion for the gravitational waves by the fact that there's the scale factor A in here. And for the Mukhanov variable, we have the Z in here. And in both cases, our assumption that we are long after horizon crossing is the assumption that the k squared has become small compared to that. Because remember, horizon crossing happens when this goes through zero. Right? Before that, we have a positive frequency here, but a positive frequency squared. But after this term dominates, we have negative frequency squared. The frequencies go imaginary, therefore. And that is what turns oscillations into exponential growth and exponential decay, or quasi-exponential growth, quasi-exponential decay. So long after horizon crossing, or actually soon after horizon crossing, we have that these terms can be neglected. And then this equation simplifies. See, because then this equation simply becomes that becomes u double prime over u is equal to z double prime over z. And similarly here, v double prime over v is a double prime over a. And that means that we have solutions where u is simply proportional to z and v is proportional to a. Because clearly, if u becomes proportional to z, that's obeyed. If v becomes proportional to a, that's obeyed. We will later do this with the actual solutions in terms of hypergeometric functions. I just want to show you that to show the inevitability of it. It's not a particular property of hypergeometric functions that lets us be lucky later on that we can draw some simple conclusions, but it had to come out this way that the growing solution has to be such that it grows at exactly the same rate that the A or the Z is growing, just because the differential equations become of that form for late time. So the mode functions, namely the Mukhanov variable, which is u tilde divided by z, and the gravitational waves mode function, which is the v tilde divided by the scale factor a, these things, therefore, become constant at late eta, just because these guys have to become proportional. So after horizon crossing, physical fields, mode functions, r tilde and h tilde, become constant. Now, this is what I showed here is just the growing solution, right? You can also look at the decaying solutions, but they're just not of interest in this context.
Can you understand that freezing as, if you look at the original equations before transforming to get rid of the damping term, as if the damping term has become so big that everything is sort of frozen
yes,
solid?
That's right. The damping term is freezing everything.
That's okay.
All right. Yeah, that's just spelling out what I said in words, namely that the scaling behavior of u tilde cancels the scaling behavior of z. Scaling behavior of v tilde is canceling the scaling behavior of of the scale factor. Right. So therefore, as expected, the magnitude of the quantum fluctuations of the mode k, which, remember, we calculated to come out like this. The quantum fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable are k to the power 3 half times the modulus of the mode function squared. And similarly, for the gravitational waves, these magnitudes of the quantum fluctuations of the modes become constant after horizon crossing, because the modulus of the mode function becomes constant. So if we hold k fixed, and we look at this at later and later times, so we look at r tilde of t, we find that this value goes like this. It starts very high and goes down, and eventually levels up, right? Because if you remember, the initially, the quantum fluctuations are large for very small quantum fluctuation for a very small wavelength. But then they decay. As the physical wavelength grows, the quantum fluctuations decay. The modulus of the wave function goes down. The modulus of the mode function goes down. But as we just established, even if it's not the Sitter inflation, what we have is that the mode function stabilizes. The modulus of the mode function stabilizes as soon as we cross the horizon. And that means that the size of the quantum fluctuations, the actual amplitude of the quantum fluctuation, remains constant after horizon crossing. So the physical wavelength of our mode k keeps growing along with the universe. But even though the wavelength becomes larger and larger and larger, the actual amplitude of the quantum fluctuations stays the same. And so if, for example, the horizon crossing happens when the mode has a wavelength of just, let's say, 10 to the 5 times the Planck length, then it has the magnitude of quantum fluctuations that you would normally observe only at extremely small wavelengths, 10 to the 5 times the Planck length, for example. And then the horizon crossing happens. The mode becomes larger and larger in wavelengths, but it keeps that size of quantum fluctuation. And the same is true for the gravitational waves. So now our goal is to calculate the magnitude of these fluctuations at horizon crossing. Afterwards, they stay the same. For this, we need a model of the expansion of the universe that's more realistic than the sitter. On one hand, because the sitter is not quite how it happened, but also because we wouldn't even know how to calculate it for the sitter. If you remember, the Mohanov variable blows up if we approach the sitter space, because there is derivative of the potential of the Hubble parameter in the denominator. And if the Hubble parameter is constant, that denominator goes to zero and the fluctuations go to infinity, which doesn't tell us that the fluctuations really go to infinity. It just tells us that our approximations break down. So what we need here is a model for slow roll inflation. So we need an explicit potential V of phi in order to then find explicit functions for the scale factor and for the behavior of the field, you know, the zero modes of them, a naught of eta and phi naught of eta, everything calculated classically, such that we get a slow roll period. And as we said, the sitter itself is ruled out because V of phi, and therefore the temporary cosmological constant, which, if you remember, is the square root of the potential, would be constant. But it must slowly decrease. It must slowly decrease for various reasons. One is for our formalism to be applicable. But secondly, also for inflation to eventually end. The potential has to go down and eventually to zero. Now, we don't know exactly what the potential of the inflaton was. And therefore, in the literature, it has become customary to parameterize our ignorance, basically to parameterize how it could look like. In principle, we expect it to look something like that, which could be something that arises, for example, from a phi to the 4 theory. But we don't know. So what is being done then is, let me just show you something here. So this is V of phi, and what we can do is effectively do a Taylor expansion of V of phi here in the slow roll period. Because during the slow roll period, the modes that are supposed to have seeded the structure formation in the universe cross the horizon. This is what we measure in the CMB, and that is what we measure in the distribution of galaxies that came from the CMB. So what we can do is we can do a Taylor expansion somewhere around here of V of phi with respect to phi. Now, on the other hand, the square root of V, the square root of the potential, is the Hubble parameter. So we can also do a Taylor expansion of the Hubble parameter. It's just a matter of Taylor expanding V or Taylor expanding its square root. So in the literature, both are being done. And for example, if you take h prime divided by h, so h prime would be like the first Taylor coefficient. If you take h prime over h squared 1 over 4 pi g, then for historical reasons, this parameter is called epsilon of phi. Now, if you assume this to be a constant, then you have literally made an assumption for a Taylor coefficient. But of course, in practice, it's going to be some function. Then you can take the second derivative divided by h, its coefficient, and in the literature, the name given to that slow roll parameter, this is the first slow roll parameter, this is called the second slow roll parameter, and the third slow roll parameter, which goes up to the third derivative. And these denominators are needed in order to get the units right so that these are just numbers. You can also re-express these things in terms of derivatives of the phi, for example, you know, telling how fast the phi is then changing. I gave you the expressions in terms for the first and the second slow roll parameters here in black, but the third one is already pretty complicated. The simplest assumption we can make here is that the first slow roll parameter is just a constant. It turns out that the accuracy of the measurements of the CMB nowadays is so high that the example that I'm giving you now is already ruled out. It has to be more complicated than this. But you know, the other slow roll parameters must come in a non-trivial way. But there's nothing to be gained in principle from increasing the complexity now for the purpose of learning how this goes about. So let us look at the simplest solvable case. And then in principle, you will see how the other cases can be done as well. So the simplest case is the case where we assume that the first slow roll parameter is just a constant. This is not the speed of light, it's just some number c, where c is a small constant for a small slope. And let's see what we get. Just a second, let me review where the epsilon is. Right? So if epsilon is a small number, then the h prime over h is small, so we have a small slope. We have that h is changing very slowly with v, which is to say that v, the potential, is changing very slowly with phi. Right? So small epsilon means slow rho. But what kind of shape do we get for the potential? Well, so if the first slow roll parameter is a constant, then this is a constant. And we can, of course, immediately integrate that equation and find out what h of phi is. And since the ratio of the derivative with respect to h is a constant, we must have that h behaves exponentially. So the h of phi, and therefore, and this is the square root of the potential of phi, is given by this exponential law, which you shouldn't think of as going like this. Of course it does, but for a sufficiently small c, this is pretty flat. So what we have here is a potential that's relatively flat. And the potential is then this one. And you can calculate what the value of s is. I gave it away, right? Square root of v is the potential up to some constant in front of it. Now, it turns out that when you fix the first slow roll parameter to be constant, not only at one value of phi, but just constant for all phi, then you have implicitly also fixed every other parameter, because you have already fixed how the potential goes. Right? You have fixed what the potential is, you have fixed what h of phi is, so the other slow roll parameters must follow. They are only independent parameters. If you fix the first slow roll parameter only at one value of phi, then you can fix the second slow roll parameter at the same value of phi and a third and so on, and you have truly Taylor expansion. But here we are just saying that the first slow roll parameter is constant for all phi, and then we get that this is the potential. And then we can calculate what the second and the third and the higher slow roll parameters are. And it just happens to arrange itself so nicely. And that's actually the reason why the prefactors were chosen in the way that they were previously. It so happens that if the first slow roll parameter is constantly c, then the second is as well, the third is as well, and all the higher ones are as well. So all those slow roll parameters simply take the value c. In this case, the expansion rate of the universe is actually polynomial instead of exponential. Remember, if it wasn't slow roll, if it was no roll, if it was just the sitter, the expansion rate would be exponential. So I leave it up to you to show that the scale factor goes like a naught, some constant, times t to the power of 1 over c in this case. All the ingredients to calculate that are in the previous slide. What does that mean? The slower the slow roll is, the closer we get to the sitter space, right? So the smaller c is, the slower is the roll. Therefore, the closer we are to the sitter space. And what we see here is that the smaller c is, the higher is the power with which this acceleration goes. So this is definitely an accelerated expansion. If c is a really small number, this is a very high power. And therefore, it's definitely a very much accelerated expansion. But there are key differences. This so-called power law inflation, because it is with a power rather than being exponential. This power law inflation differs in two important ways. One is that you don't actually get the sitter inflation ever in this way. Even if you let c go to zero, it doesn't really become exponential. It doesn't become e to the power constant times t anyway. So it's not a limit that you can take smoothly. And the sitter space has no Big Bang. This has a Big Bang. See? Because for t going to zero, the scale factor actually goes to zero. So with a power law inflation, we have a model of a universe that actually starts with a bang, in the sense that the scale factor started with zero at a finite amount of time. And then it exploded. Whereas in the case of the sitter space, you can go back as far as you want in time, but the scale factor is never zero. By the way, this does not mean that the universe started small. It had a Big Bang. It doesn't mean it started small. That's because the scale factor is just multiplying all distances. But if the universe is spatially R3, then it's spatially R3 at any time. So if you take power law inflation for a universe that is spatially R3, spatially flat, then at arbitrarily small times, it's always infinite in size. Only at time t equals zero, it has no size at all, because the scale factor is multiplying R3 with zero. But for any finite amount of time, it's infinite. So that would be a universe then, which starts out infinite in size and then expands from there. Doesn't have to be this way. You could also write down an FRW spacetime where the spatial sections are spheres of a finite volume. And then you have literally an expanding universe in the sense that this ball is expanding with the scale factor. It starts at zero size, and then it becomes the size of an orange, and then the size of the Earth, and so on. But if the universe is not the size of a ball, but instead is R3 or is some hyperbolic space that is of infinite size, then you shouldn't think of it as its volume increase. It's always infinite. Okay, so now we have the scale factor as a function of time. We can again calculate the conformal time. This was proper time. We can calculate the conformal time from the a of t. If you remember, by integrating, it's the same calculation as if you want to calculate the particle horizon. The conformal time, in the case of power law inflation, comes out to be such that the scale factor in terms of conformal time is a of eta is minus 1 over eta h times this. That would be 1 in the case of the sitter inflation. But in the case of power law inflation, we have this value here, and it just, you know, rescales the conformal time a little bit. So what we have is that this is just some positive number. Epsilon is small. Epsilon is small, so this is just some positive number here. And what we see here is that, as usual, the conformal time is negative, and it runs from past infinity, where conformal time is minus infinity, all the way to the infinite future, where conformal time approaches zero from the left, as before, just like in the Sitter space. And the fact that conformal time is finite, I mean, that conformal time reaches only a finite value, if you remember, is a consequence of the fact that the universe is accelerating and therefore has a horizon, which means that there's a finite, co-moving distance that the light ray can possibly cover. Even if the light ray travels forever, the co-moving distance that it can cover is finite. That was the definition of having a horizon. I mean, you can't communicate further than this distance, even with light. Light cannot travel more than this co-moving distance. And if you remember, the conformal time is up to an arbitrary constant, where you start your conformal time, it is the co-moving distance traveled by a beam of light. So in power law inflation, we still have accelerated expansion, clearly, right? If C is small, this is clearly an accelerated expansion because the second derivative is positive. And therefore, we have a horizon, and therefore the conformal time must end at a finite point in time, which of course doesn't mean that proper time ends, right? Proper time goes on forever. It's just conformal time that ends at zero. All right, now let's look at the mode equations for the case of power law inflation. We can now calculate this mysterious factor z or z of eta, because we have a of eta. So a squared divided by a prime times phi naught prime of eta, we can calculate that as well. All of these things can be calculated. And therefore, we can also calculate the term z double prime over z explicitly, which is the term that goes into the Klein-Gordon equation for the Mukhanov variable. And if we do that, a little calculation shows that the z double prime over z term becomes nu squared minus a quarter divided by eta squared. So for power law inflation, the Mukhanov variable's associated variable, the one without the friction term, obeys this Klein-Gordon equation, where nu is this parameter here. It is 3/2 plus c over 1 minus c. I don't think we should spend time in deriving exactly these things. It's all pretty straightforward, right? We have the potential. We can calculate what this is. We just add the a. All of this can be calculated. Calculate z double prime over z. Plug it in here. Point is that the power law constant, the constant c, which defines which power law we have, goes into here. C is a small number. So therefore, that is a small positive number here. Small positive number. Remember, C equals zero, strictly equal to zero, would be the case of the Sitter space. Let's see if we recover it here. If C is equal to zero, that term is absent, and we have here 3/2. But 3/2, nu is 3/2. Here we have to square it. That gives us 9/4. And then we have here 9/4 minus a quarter. That's 8/4. That's 2. And that means that this term becomes 2 divided by eta squared. If you scroll back in your notes, you find that that's what we have for the Sitter space. For the Sitter space, this is a 2 up here. So actually, in the Klein-Gordon equation, the limit from power law to the Sitter is fine. It's not for the quantum fluctuations later on, but here for the Klein-Gordon equation, that limit is fine. So for the for power law, we have a slightly modified differential equation. Instead of having here simply a factor of 2, we have this number here, which is a little larger than 2, because the nu is a little larger than 3/2. Now we can calculate what the solution is to this differential equation, or we can just look it up in any text on hypergeometric functions, and we find that now the solution is conveniently expressed not in Bessel functions, but in Hankel functions. So the solution of this differential equation with the Bunch-Davis initial conditions is this one. So this caveat of with Bunch-Davis initial conditions means this. That's the unique solution out of this two complex dimensional solution space, which obeys the Wronskian condition, and which, when you run it back in time to, if you just take eta to go to minus infinity, so the past infinity, when the mode was much, much smaller than the horizon, when the mode was basically Siemienkowski space, because its wavelength was much smaller than the horizon, then this expression becomes simply the same expression that we had for quantum field theory and Minkowski space, the same mode function. So this becomes the mode function for quantum field theory and Minkowski space at early times, but it obeys that equation at all times. So if we assume that the mode was in the Minkowski vacuum or the Bunch-Davis vacuum at very early times, then we have to choose this mode function. Where you see that that the parameter nu comes in two different places. It comes in here in the order of the Hankel function, and it also comes up here. Remember, in the case of the sitter, this would be 3/2, so that's just a 2, so that's e to the I pi, which is just minus 1. And in the case where nu is 3/2 for the sitter, this would become a Bessel function. Or a linear combination of the Bessel function. Maybe the one for the sine and the one for the cosine, because this becomes a plane wave. This is a complex solution. Now, we can look up what the behavior of this function is. You don't have to derive that from scratch. It's well known how the Hankel functions behave asymptotically. And the behavior at late times, namely from horizon crossing onwards, is this. Namely that the what kind of variables associated fields mode function behaves like this at late times, which is to say for small eta. When eta approaches zero, or actually when it crosses the horizon. You see that nu equals 3/2 is critical in this number, for example, it's over there, and it's also over here. Now, knowing what the mode function's behavior is from horizon crossing onwards, or at horizon crossing, allows us to calculate the quantum fluctuation size at horizon crossing, and we know it's not going to change after that. How did we calculate that? Well, we had to take the modulus squared of, well, no, just the modulus of that function in order to get the fluctuations of the Mukhanov variable. And we had to put in the scale factor, or in this case, actually the Z factor, in order to go from the associated Mukhanov variable without the friction term to the actual, back to the actual kind of variable. If we do all of that, this is the final answer. So this is kind of the most, perhaps the most important equation in the course. Because what it tells us is what the predicted size of the quantum fluctuation of the Mukhanov variable is as a function of the mode that we are considering from horizon crossing onwards, in terms of the Hubble parameter. Now, we were anticipating that this equation would be slightly non-trivial, not like in the case of just a plain Klein-Gordon field, without, I mean, how we initially calculated the fluctuations of a Klein-Gordon field on a background space-time. Because instead of having just the scale factor in here, we had the Z factor. And the Z was slightly modified over the A. And here we see what the implications of that are. Having worked with the Mukhanov variable, instead of just a straight Klein-Gordon field, we get all these prefactors. And what they do is, just a few lines for you to do this exercise, in order to get that equation here, what they do is they make this amplitude of the quantum fluctuations not proportional h, Hubble constant, which is what we had obtained earlier for just a Klein-Gordon field on a curved expanding background. No, now we get that the quantum fluctuations are, apart from some prefactors here, which are just numerical, the size of the quantum fluctuations from horizon crossing onwards is given by the Hubble parameter squared divided by the change in the Hubble parameter, rate of change of the Hubble parameter, the modulus of it. Now, we should have expected that there's an h prime in the denominator, or some power of h prime in the denominator. Why? Well, because, as we discussed earlier, if we take the Mukhanov variable and we let things go towards the sitter, it blows up. Because we had the phi prime, we had the v prime in the denominator. The phi naught prime in the denominator. Cannot go to the sitter without the thing blowing up. So what we have here is the same thing. We have that if it was no roll instead of slow roll, then h would be constant. H prime would be zero. But if h prime is zero, then this thing blows up, and the size of the fluctuations would be infinite. Again, it doesn't mean that they really are infinite. It just means that our assumptions completely break down, and we shouldn't do that calculation in the first place. So we got what we qualitatively expected. We get a modified expression for the quantum fluctuations here, in the sense that it's not just h, as it would be for just a plain spectator Klein-Gordon field on a background expanding space-time. We get something more complicated, and that something more complicated blows up if we go from slow roll to no roll. And this is the actual expression of it. We can evaluate that at horizon crossing. And remember, we should evaluate that at horizon crossing. The important point is that every mode crosses the horizon at a different point in time. Right? Some modes reach the size of the horizon earlier. Some modes start smaller, so they reach the size of the horizon later. But the size of the horizon changes over time. Only in the sitter space would the size of the horizon always be the same. But for power law, that's not the case. The size of the horizon changes over time. For any other than the sitter space, the size of the horizon changes over time, which means that the modes will cross the horizon when the horizon has different sizes, and therefore each mode has its amplitude of quantum fluctuations frozen in at different levels. You know, what size quantum fluctuations a mode has depends on how old it is, how much has it already expanded until it reaches the size of the horizon. So for every mode, we need to calculate when it crosses the horizon, and then how big is the horizon at that point in time, or in other words, what is the Hubble parameter at that point in time, what is its derivative at that point in time, calculate that ratio multiplied with these numerical factors here, and then we get the size of the fluctuations of the variable. Now, the Mukhanov variable is thought to have seeded the initial inhomogeneities in the inflaton field, or more accurately, at the end of inflation, the initial fluctuations in the intrinsic curvature, which then, after some 370,000 years of plasma physics, until the cosmic microwave background was free to roam the universe, translated itself into temperature fluctuation. So the idea is that these fluctuations, or the effect of these fluctuations, we now see in the cosmic microwave background as temperature fluctuation. Now, if that is so, and there's very good reason to believe that this is so, it means that the temperature fluctuation spectrum of the cosmic microwave background cannot tell us the size change, cannot tell us what the size of the Hubble parameter was when the modes crossed the horizon. The reason being that this is what the measurements would tell us. Right? I mean, these are just numbers, numerical. Fine. No doubt about these numbers. But this is a ratio. So we do know how big the fluctuations are. It's like one part in a million. 10 parts in a million, the temperature fluctuation. And that tells us how big that number is. But it doesn't tell us how big H is or how big H prime is. However, we do have some evidence of this rolling. And we have some evidence that these fluctuations are k-dependent, as they should be. So we have that H prime should not be zero, and modes crossed the horizon when the horizon was different size. The fluctuations were frozen in at different heights. Now, let us look at the gravitational waves then.
We should also know the size of the value of nu in that equation, right? Nu, I mean.
Oh, yes, well, that's right. Nu is given by the Sorow parameter. So if we assume that the expansion was described by power law, then nu tells us what power.
Yes, but only measuring h over h square over h prime without knowing will.
Well, that's the thing. You see, we measure not just one number here. We measure one number for every k. Because we don't just measure one temperature in the sky, we measure the temperature spectrum. So we measure that for every k. We measure, you know, delta r of k. And this calculation makes a particular prediction for how that spectrum looks like. And it doesn't match experiments. So the experiments are indicating that no value for nu describes exactly what we see. So whatever you choose for your slower parameter epsilon, as long as you believe it's constant and you therefore get power law inflation, you can't exactly match experiments. You can get very close, but apparently within sufficiently many standard deviations, you can rule out power law already, which means that it wasn't a good enough approximation to say that the slower parameter epsilon was constant. What we should do is say, OK, at this particular value of the field, it has this value. And the second slower parameter has that value. The third has that value. And we keep those values open for now. And then we play around with these values until we match the experimental data. Now, some people say, yeah, that's not very predictive, right? Because you just fiddle with your parameters. Like von Neumann is said to have said that if you give me four parameters, I can fit an elephant.
That's not people.
I saw it too. You can fit an elephant. If you give me a fifth one, I can make it wiggle its trunk, right? And so basically, yeah, if you allow arbitrary potentials, if you allow arbitrary slow roll potentials, you can basically fit whatever data you want. Now, it's difficult to draw a definite conclusion from this. On one hand, you can say that if I make the assumption that the general inflationary scenario is right, then this procedure allows me from experimental data to fix and measure the Taylor coefficient of the potential. But then others might say, well, yeah, but how do you know that the inflationary scenario is right? So there are two camps on this, and they don't agree on that.
Just out of curiosity, do you happen to know how much consensus there is that we should be using the Mukhanov variable for getting the CMB density fluctuations?
I think there's no doubt about that.
Okay. Just curious.
No, I think that's just the standard. Right. So, right. I think I said already all those decent things, but let's see. Earlier, for Klein-Gordon field in a fixed background, when we did not yet know about the Mukhanov variable in these things, we calculated the fluctuation spectrum, and we found that the fluctuation spectrum of a Klein-Gordon field is proportional to the Hubble constant or the Hubble parameter. But now, for the Mukhanov variable, we found that it's proportional to h squared divided by h prime. As we should, because we know that things should blow up as we go from slow roll to no roll. Now, RK is the slicing independent combination of the scalar part of the metric and the Klein-Gordon field. And the slower the roll, the wider away from. Remember the picture with the plane and the river in there, right? And the more.
It's the next slide.
Is it? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So I just wanted to remind you about why it is that the Mukhanov variable becomes bad when we approach the Sitter space. Right? It becomes bad because the gauge invariance of the Mukhanov variable relies on there being enough slow roll. So that whatever fluctuation you want to undo by a new choice of coordinates, for example, you have a fluctuation of the intrinsic curvature, and you want to change your coordinate system so that there's no longer a fluctuation of intrinsic curvature, then you have to be able to make that choice of new coordinate system. Or let's say your inflaton field has some fluctuation, and you want to make a choice of new coordinate system such that the inflaton field is actually constant. Well, if the inflaton field is locally too large and you want to change your coordinate such that it's not, that it's constant for equal time, and if you have slow roll, you know that you just have to go a little bit further into the future, so to speak, for your new slicing of space-time, because you know that because of the general tendency of the slow roll, the phi will go down, for example, and then you know you can always do it. But if there is no slow roll, there is no guarantee that you can actually always find a new slicing of space-time to undo the fluctuations either in the inflaton field or in the intrinsic curvature. So for fundamental reasons, it cannot be true that the Mukhanov variable is a valid gauge, is truly gauge invariant as you approach no roll. It's basically saying that a river in a complete plane, I mean a completely even plane, has no direction whatsoever. And so its fluctuations go to infinity. Okay, so let's remember the timeline here. What we just calculated is these delta r's at the end of inflation. Actually, we calculated them at each of their horizon crossing time, but we know that after their individual horizon crossing times, they maintain the size of these fluctuations until the end of inflation. I think we said all of these things. Right. Okay. So I'm saying here best fit today, but I can't really guarantee that it's really today. I guess there are more accurate measurements nowadays, but you can already see that the predictions for the fluctuations in the CMB, and that's the actual temperature spectrum of the CMB, the predictions and the measurements are really very, very close. Of course, in the predictions, we have three parameters that needed to be fixed, such as h squared over h prime. And I mean, that's the primary one, but also there's a little bit of a slope. So there's the slow roll parameter and so on. But if you choose these things, and it's not many parameters that we have to choose, it's like 3-4 parameters that we choose, then we get a curve that matches the data very, very accurately. And of course, it's many more measurement points than there are parameters that went into the description of the potential. By the way, let me just mention that because it's cool. What can also be deduced from the CMB spectrum is that space-time is spatially, as far as we can tell, flat. So we live in a k equals zero universe as far as we can tell. We can also read off from this data that the cosmological constant contributes about 70% of all of the energy density in the universe, that the remaining 30% are in matter. However, 90% of that dark matter, 90% of that matter is actually dark, and only 10% of these 30% is actually the visible matter that we know about. The energy density in the cosmic microwave background contributes only about 10 parts in a million to the total energy density in the universe. Also, we can tell from this, and especially from the very left of it, we can tell the peculiar velocity of the Earth. So remember that a peculiar velocity is a velocity on top of just expanding, going along with the flow of the expansion of the universe. And the Earth, or our solar system, has a peculiar velocity, apparently, on the order of about 370 kilometers per second. So we are moving with a speed of about 370 kilometers per second relative to the CMB. And of course, that changes with the seasons, right? Because we are traveling around the sun at the order of magnitude of like 25 kilometers a second.
Raw CMB is part of raw visible, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it counts as, it doesn't count as dark matter, no. That's right. Okay, now finally, the tensor modes. There, the calculations should be pretty much the way that we calculated in the course earlier, because the Klein-Gordon equation for the tensor modes is exactly the Klein-Gordon equation that we considered all along. So we obtain, in the case of power law inflation, we obtain for A double prime over A this value here. So that is the number that goes into here. And
just a moment.
Right. Now, that depends on time. And so if we plug all of, if we plug in the time dependence, we obtain that A double prime over A is 1 over eta squared times this. And again, let us check for consistency what happens if we let the power law parameter nu, epsilon, c, if we let that approach the sitter. So if a slow roll becomes no roll, remember that nu becomes 3/2. So that then becomes, again, 9/4. Minus 1/4 is 8/4, so it's 2. So this is 2 divided by eta squared. And that means we have, again, 2 divided by eta squared. That was the Klein-Gordon equation for the sitter space. Now, again, this equation of motion is solved by a Hankel function. Now we have here, instead of 2 divided by eta squared, we have this number divided by eta squared. And the Hankel function solution is this one. In order to get a prediction for the magnitude of the gravitational wave fluctuations, we have to evaluate at horizon crossing. For each mode, that's a different value of the Hubble parameter, namely the value that the Hubble parameter has when it crosses the horizon. And as we might have anticipated and did anticipate, we get just the fluctuations are proportional to the Hubble parameter. There is no such business as h squared over h prime occurring in this. It's just straightforwardly the Hubble parameter. And that tells us why it is so valuable. It will be so valuable if we can measure the gravitational wave spectrum. Because it will mean that, given that we know those numbers here, and there's not such a strong dependence on mu, given that we have these numbers here, we would find out what h is. And when we find out what h is, we find out what h prime is. Because of having measured h squared over h prime, using the Mokanov variable and the temperature fluctuation. Now, that has been studied in great detail. I don't think we should go into all those details. But you see here that there's a definite relationship between the predictions for the tensor modes, for the gravitational waves, and the predictions for the temperature fluctuations for the Mokanov variable. Predictions that are intrinsic, in fact, to inflationary models, that do not depend on the choice of potential. The last thing I just said is very important. We could do this calculation for models other than power law inflation. And you would still find that there's a relationship between the scalar fluctuations and the tensor fluctuations. It's a so-called scalar-tensor consistency condition. And the holy grail of inflationary physics is to measure the tensor fluctuations, to measure the scalar fluctuations, and in particular their spectra, of course, their k-dependence, and then check whether they are consistent, because they cannot be independent. Inflation links them, no matter what the potential is. So it is true that the potential is something that we don't know beforehand. We can only reconstruct it from the data, which is a weak spot of inflation. It would be much nicer if we could simply say, well, the potential has to be such and such, and therefore the predictions come out that and that. No, we don't know what the inflaton's potential should be. So the best we can do is reconstruct the inflaton potential. So rather than inflation having a predictive power, we just use it as a vehicle to reconstruct what the inflaton potential might have been. But further than that, the moment we can calculate what the spectrum of the tensor fluctuations is, we can go through this consistency, we can check whether there is any potential such that this observed tensor spectrum can come along with that observed scalar spectrum. And that would be the holy grail. If that could be measured, then that would be very strong evidence either for or against inflation. To be completely honest, we could still go around it. If these things were measured and you would find that it violates the consistency condition between scalar and tensor fluctuations in inflation, you could go around it by considering models that have not just one inflaton field, but have multiple inflaton fields and other tricks. But then people would no longer like it, because it becomes complicated, it becomes contrived. If you have other good reasons to consider multi-field inflation, then so be it. But if you're only introducing multi-field inflation to fix something that you should have predicted properly, then that really takes away from the predictive power of inflation. So either way, the hope is that we will find out that experiments, and there are a number of experiments out there that try to measure the tensor fluctuations in the CMB, in Planck satellite, for example. If we can measure these things, then it will be a very strong test of inflation. Of course, a lot of people are rooting here for inflation. So that would be great if we could confirm all of this. But of course, the most fruitful thing would be if it wasn't, if we were forced to reconsider everything, because then we would be forced, with evidence to back it up, to find a theory that even works even better. So we have something that works very well, but then upcoming measurements of the tensor fluctuations really put it on the test, and then we either confirm and we can say, yep, we have a great theory there, or we are forced, with experimental evidence, to go even better. Right, so Hij should have left some some curl field in the polarization field of the CMB. And yes, yeah, if you read something or hear something about e-polarization in the CMB, that's important for many astrophysical reasons, but the e-field doesn't tell us at all about gravitational waves. And there is plenty of e-field. So basically the only the polarization field that we've seen so far consists almost entirely of e-polarization. Consists almost entirely only of gradient field. And the little bit of b-polarization that has been observed might as well be a contamination from e-polarization having been turned, or temperature fluctuation having been turned into b-polarization because of some dust or something like that. So the big challenge is to distinguish, to first of all to measure polarization fluctuations of the curl kind in the cosmic microwave background, to separate it from some bipolarization that might have other origins. And then if we can measure it, then I should say that not only will this be a great test for the inflationary scenario, but also it will be an observation of gravitational waves. In the rack, it will be the observation of an effect of gravitational waves, but still, it would be the third time that we measure gravitational waves. Do you know what the first was?
The binary pulsar.
Yeah, when they inspire, that's right.
What was my question? Primordial gravity waves, like cosmic gravity wave background, would that tell us anything about inflation? Or is that too early?
No, that would tell us, but super difficult to measure.
Yeah.